This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today, once again, we are interviewing Jennifer Holt. He's founder and president of Owl Research Institute in Charlo, Montana, which is about 20 miles south of Flathead Lake. Today, it's one of the Owl Research Institute is one of the premier owl research centers in the world. Denver's published numerous scientific papers and is a widely published author. He's been featured in many articles from National Geographic to the New York Times, as well as in many television programs. He's educated and entertained people from all walks of life. So, Denver, welcome back. It's good to be talking to you once again. I have a lot more questions to ask.
Okay, thanks again, and I'll try my best.
So let's once again talk about the two types of owls, the Tritonidae and the Strigidae.
Okay. The two families, the way they're broken down. So, again, so you have one order. There's like about 36 orders of birds in the world, and it's just based on mostly, you know, when early taxonomists are doing it, you know, morphology, who kind of looked like. Oh, the hares and egrets look good over here, you know. The foxes and the wolves and the coyotes look good over here, so they're all lumped together. And then they kind of break it down from there, you know, who has similar traits. This one goes in that category, this one goes in that category. So some of the owl species, for example, those 25, 27 or so species in the Tritonidae, and then the rest, the 240, 41 or so species in the Strigidae, the typical owls, basically, they would break it down something like this. If you were in the family of the barn owls, the bay owls, the Tritonidae, which are the older group that have been around for a while, you know, they all have kind of like a heart-shaped face. They don't have ear tufts. They all have brown eyes. They have little rounded ear openings. Their, you know, primary feathers are very rounded and don't have emarginations on them. And there's no notching, you know, on it as well. And then the Strigidae, they have like a rounded face, the other family. They can have ear tufts and not have ear tufts. They have various eye colors. They have long slit-like ears. Their feathers are tapered and emarginated. You know, so there's differences in just their basic morphology, and then there's differences in their skeletal morphology. Like, you know, the Tritonids or the barn owls, they all have a small head and a long rostrum or a long bill. Small orbits, you know, things like that. And then the Strigidae have a big head, a short rostrum, large orbits. So that's how they break them down into the two families. And there's some other traits as well, but I don't want to keep going here.
On an evolutionary basis, do they have a common ancestor?
Yeah, and in theory, you know, we all share a common ancestor. And so as far as the owls go, you know, you can go back, let's see here. I'm just going to see if I can figure this out. There's been at least four, I think there's geological time here. There's at least four different families of owls that, you know, have kind of like come and gone.
Mm.
And the Tritonids or the barn and the bay owls are the last known, you know, group of owls that kind of survived. And then from there, so they're the older taxa, and then the other owls have kind of evolved after that.
Are there more Tritonidae in other parts of the world?
You know, there seems to be quite a few in Australia, which I find kind of interesting. They have quite a few Tritonids down there. I can't remember how many species, but, you know, there's only about 27 or so species in the world. But there seems to be quite a divergence of them down in Australia for some reason.
Hmm. Yeah, they look like barn owls?
Yeah, they all have the kind of that, you know, the heart-shaped face.
Uh-huh.
You know, dark eyes, a heart-shaped face, and, you know, almost like hunchbacked a little bit, too, you know. So they're the older group, and then the newer group is the Strigids, again, what we call the typical owls. I don't even know what that means. But One of the things that we've learned over the years, and you know, the geologists have kind of figured that out there, is that when they are excavating places, they find, you know, all these bones and all that stuff, and you can identify species, or they can, just, you know, by one bone. But femurs in birds seem to withstand geological time fairly well, and they've identified femurs and of what they believe are owls that date back 55 to 65 million years ago. You know, those families have since been extirpated, and then, you know, they kind of like reemerge in a sense or re-evolve, but, you know, 30 to 50 million years ago, the barn owls and the bay owls were like the only one left by the Pleistocene. And as time has gone on, you know, to present, modern genera of owls have appeared. So it's pieced together through fossil evidence as well as molecular evidence these days.
I gather that most owls are nocturnal. Are there some that are diurnal?
Yeah, for sure. You know, pygmy owls you might consider diurnal, or some people like to use crepuscular, you know, the low light levels in morning and evening. Most species you would say are nocturnal or nearly so. But, you know, some of them, like I said, the pygmy owl, burrowing owl, snowy owl, are often out and about by day. And then, of course, that changes a little bit with raising a family. So if you have a bunch of mouths to feed, you might be out a little bit more than normal because you have to provide food.
So during when you're out in the forest and you're looking for owls that are really hard to see, they're well camouflaged, right?
Yeah. You know, we like to say inconspicuous locations, coloration and patterning and behavior make it really difficult to find owls. But if you know a little bit about their vocalizations, a little bit about the breeding season, you can go out and do surveys, locate a bird that might be singing from the same general location over a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then when it stops vocalizing, there's a chance that it could be breeding. That's when you go in and you try to find the physical evidence that they're breeding.
Uh-huh. Are there any owls that are on the endangered species list?
You know, there are. I think they tend to be more tropical forest owls, and particularly over, I think as you move over into the subcontinent of India, there's some there. And I can't remember which ones they are at the moment here. But in the U.S. and Canada, you know, the spotted owl, of course, is of concern to some. And it's just difficult to, you know, it's difficult to kind of figure all of this out because the birds themselves are so difficult to find. You know, there's been owls that have been thought to be extinct that have all of a sudden been found again, and, you know, accidentally or so. So it's tough, but there's certainly owls that are on the endangered species list. And again, I can't remember which ones they are, but I know I've read about them. And then there's owls that, you know, the snowy owl is considered vulnerable, whatever that means right now. So, yeah, and then the best thing to do is look at your state designations. And very often, like in Montana, for example, we have these designations that are, you know, species of concern, for example. Well, when we get that, it kind of generates at least a little bit of money and a little bit of interest to go out and do surveys. And once we go out and do surveys, we tend to find in most species, particularly here in Montana, that they were far more abundant than we previously thought.
So there are no species that are on the threshold of being on the endangered species lists?
You know, I don't think so. And I know people are concerned about the spotted owl, but endangered species list in the U.S., you know, the ferruginous pygmy owl down in southwest, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, I think it's on the northern edge of its distribution, primarily in Mexico south. But I can't remember the status, but they have a high-level status down there where they are just, you know, extend into the U.S.
In the Pacific Northwest, there's conflict between barred owls that are displacing spotted owls. What's your take on that problem?
Got to be careful. You know, it's interesting. You know, I think, you know, overall, it was probably about just, you know, poor forest management and all that. But now that we're here, what's it all about? You know, I have mixed feelings on that. You know, I study owls. They have a place in my heart, all of them. I'm not so crazy about killing all the brown owls, to be honest. You know, but I think that the researchers have also shown that, you know, the barred owls can have effect on the spotted owls. I think the thing that concerns me the most is that the designation of invasive. What does that really mean? And so we have a student right now going back to look at a couple of these papers that were published in 2009 and reevaluating what the authors said about that. And just, you know, kind of, you know, looking at it from a more, you know, strengths and weaknesses perspective versus just because it's published doesn't mean it's true, you know. So we're looking at that. And then how are you going to deal with this in the future? You know, I'm of the belief that barred owls are pretty adaptable and might have just spread naturally north of the border and dropped into Glacier, those areas there, northern Idaho, Washington, many, many years ago. Others believe that they're invasive and they wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the influences of, you know, people or man and all that. So we're looking at it right now. We're doing a big reevaluation of, you know, the word invasive and if it really matters, you know. They're here, so now what do we do? But did they get here naturally? Did they get here because of, you know, anthropogenic reasons? I don't know if we know the answer. There's definitely different schools on either side. Some people believing one way and some the other.
Yeah, the first I became aware of the issue was an article I read in Audubon magazine, which seemed to justify the shooting of the barred owls in order to save the spotted.
Yeah, it may be. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's a... I don't know. There's definitely a part of me like to see how's it going to turn out if you just leave it all alone. But I understand the concerns on the other end as well. But how far do you go? You know, do you go from Northern California to Oregon, Washington, east to Idaho, east to Montana, and kill all the barred owls there? I don't know. You know, will they fill in just as fast as you do it? You know, when they introduced peregrine falcons in many areas, when they were extirpated, they went and shot all the great horned owls. And, you know, the next year there was another pair of great horned owls there. So, who knows?
Okay, let's talk about some individual species. Tell me about the northern hawk owl. Do you have them up there? And why are they called the hawk owl?
I think they're called the hawk owl because they kind of look like a hawk and kind of look like an owl, and you get to see them more often. They're out in the daytime, and they kind of like that, have that long tail, almost like an occipital hawk. So I think that's a reasonable description of them. You know, years ago in Glacier Park, there was a biologist there that was doing some wolf surveys, and he came upon a hawk owl. I think he found it coming in and out of a hole in a tree. And we, at that time, were, you know, doing some owl stuff, and they asked us to come up there and look at it. And that kind of started a, I don't know, 20-plus-year project on hawk owls and Glacier National Park and the Flathead National Forest. And so they seemed to just show up after burns. It was kind of interesting, almost like the woodpeckers do. And so we started that study up in there, very difficult to work in. And what we found is that, you know, there'd be a burn, and then the hawk owls would show up, maybe because all the vegetation was, you know, coming back, and the grasses and, you know, the shrubs and things like that. And that was food for small mammals, and the hawk owls moved in and hunted the small mammals. Whatever it was, Glacier Park was kind of like the epicenter of it. And since then, you know, other people have found them burns to the south and maybe a little bit to the east or so. But anyway, pretty neat. And then they up and disappear after a while. So maybe the forest starts to, you know, regenerate, and it's no longer easy to hunt, and they move on to the next place.
There are three species of screech owls, whiskered and eastern and western. What's the difference between them?
Well, distribution, for one, you know, when the early naturalists were cataloging the fauna and flora of our country here, you know, basically they were shooting stuff, and in order to do it and take notes, they thought all the screech owls were just screech owls because they all looked alike. And then, you know, as, you know, technology kind of advanced a little bit and we're able to record vocalizations or even good naturalists who went out there and just listened, one of the things that, you know, they clearly noted was that screech owl that looked so similar in eastern Montana, for example, sounded like this. And that screech owl in western Montana that looked similar to eastern Montana sounded like this. So they look kind of similar, but they have different vocalizations. And so what we've learned over time, thanks to a lot of patience by the early researchers, is that in owls, if it sounds different, it is a different species. You know, their vocalizations are not learned, they're inherited. And so they have basically the same vocalizations. And the molecular data now has backed that up. So these screech owls we have in the U.S., but in particular, you know, where I am in western Montana and eastern Montana, are different species based on voice, even though they may look similar. And as you move down to the south, there's whistler screech owl, or down into the tropics, so many of these screech owls, and there are many species, look all alike, except they all sound different.
Is there a species you'd like to talk about?
You know, I don't know. I mean, our snowy owl research has received so much, you know, national and international attention that sometimes I feel bad for the other species. And our long-eared owl project, you know, is 37 years going now. It's probably the longest and most detailed study in the world, certainly North America. And it's a species that, because it's so nocturnal and so secretive by day, that not a lot of people get to see. And our data, now we have several thousand birds marked here in western Montana. And so we do mark recapture. We do a lot of stuff, you know, from genetics and hormones to basic banding and monitoring. I think the important thing from a research perspective, the other stuff is really nice, but the long-term monitoring, I think, is really the way to go, if possible. So that's one of the ones that I... You know, for us, all our studies tend to be long-term, and I think that's, you know, something we forget to do anymore, which everything is slam-bam anymore. But our long-and-off study is pretty neat. We've learned a lot about them. We've learned that something, for example, you find 10 long-and-offs sitting in a roost in the wintertime. Next year, you come back, and there's 10 long-and-offs in the same roost in the same branches, and none of them or one of them is marked. And so there's a huge turnover every year, is what we've learned over the years from marking and recapturing. So that's kind of neat. And then the mating system, they pretty much switch mates every year. Even though the same nest can be used, it's a different pair almost every year. I think only one time we've had the same pair breed in the same nest with each other in consecutive years.
What do you want to know about owls that you don't currently know?
You know, I don't know. I, you know, you're still learning all the time. I think, you know, the old adage, you know, the more you know, the less you know. I think as you get older, you find that to be quite true. And, you know, all the things I might have thought when I was younger, maybe now I think, ooh, gosh, I wonder if I was either on the wrong track or had I gotten more data would have led me to a different conclusion. So I was given a talk recently at the World Owl Conference, and I was a keynote speaker, and I spoke on long-eared owls, and I put the graph up of the 36 or 7 years of the population fluctuations, and then I put the graph up with the snowy owl, and I said, now, if you were to study this species during these years right here, which is a typical graduate study, you would conclude this. If you move down the road a little ways here, and if you study them during this period, you would conclude something opposite. But if you study them for 30-plus years, you would see, hey, they're doing okay. Their populations fluctuate. And it's the same thing with the snowy owls, except their population is seeing a long-term decline, at least in our study area. So long-term research, but people don't want to do that, you know. And I emphasize it a lot, and I know it's you know, it kind of pisses people off, I think. But the approach we have anymore is it's just boom, in and out, publish as many papers as you possibly can with the same data set. and then move on. And I don't think we're getting the best data by doing that.
You have several live cameras scattered around. Tell us about them. Where are they located?
They're all located in No-Tell'em Creek, and they're scattered about from the Arctic to western Montana. Those are the two geographic areas. And what we do with those, we work with the Foundation out of California, the Annenberg Foundation, and we try to find these nests, and then, you know, we've done it now for a while, and we put live cameras on 24/7 with infrared, and we're able to bring to the world the life of these owls during the breeding season. You know, when I first started out, and I had to justify getting grant money, I said, oh, we reached 500 people or 10 school groups or 200 of these, and now we can reach millions and millions of people who watch our cameras and watch the owls and osprey we have as well, but watch the owls raise their families and look at the behaviors and stuff. So we learn a lot from things that we couldn't see at night, but we're also providing people just a glimpse into the breeding season of some of these birds, like the snowy owl. No, there was never, ever a camera in the world, a live camera, to watch the breeding of snowy owls in the Arctic. We've done it four times now. Long-eared owls, hardly ever seen, the same thing. Great horns a little more popular, screech owls a little more popular for cams. So the cams have been very good from an educational standpoint and a research standpoint, and we tried to do little updates, and sometimes in the live chats, I'll stand by a nest with the cameras on, do a little live chat to the public.
So how can people look at those images that the cameras take?
Well, you want to go to explore.org. That's the group we work with. And then you can see cameras from all over the world. If you wanted to watch beluga whales in the Arctic or the fishing bears in Alaska or an African waterhole or a snowy owl nest or whatever, these cams are out there. You can watch the surf in California. You can watch fish floating around in an aquarium. So explore.org has provided this for the world to see. It's really, really cool. And we're just, you know, one of a number of groups that works with Explore to expose our group to animals that we work on, which are the owls. And they're really, really neat.
Explore.org.
It's
not on your website.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's not on your website. It's explore.org.
Yeah, and you can go to our website, too, and we also talk about it. But explore.org, you'll see all the banners.
Okay.
You know, and then you can go from there. And what they've done at Explore is pretty remarkable.
What are the publications that you've put out?
I don't know. You know, I'm less likely to write anymore. It all depends. You know, I think when I was younger, it was more important to publish. Now, as I look back on that stuff, I think, that wasn't all that good paper. But you know, we've gone from children's science books, where we've brought in a school teacher to take the lead, and we provide the kind of like technical information to, you know, just pure descriptive biology, to some experimental research, to long-term monitoring. A few of our papers have been, you know, the cover story for, you know, some of the top journals in the country, and we've won some awards. So from purely descriptive children's books and descriptive natural history to a little more rigorous, you know, I hate to use the word scientific, but a little more rigorous natural history. And with a scientific approach, but, you know, all that is really a good question trying to get at it. So there's one. Yeah, we've done a number of them over the years, and we just don't have time to write, you know. I mean, we have...
There's a publication you have called Owls, Who Are They? Is that a children's book?
Yeah, that was a third grade teacher in Missoula, a friend of mine who asked me to come to her class and give a talk on owls, and I said, I'm not coming to a kid's class. Anyway, as a friend, she forced me to, so I went there. And the kids were pretty well prepared, I thought, and And we just got to be chatting afterwards. I said, you know, if we provide the data, why don't you write a children's book and we'll get an artist? And that's how it's happened. And then we did another one. And we have a third one that's been sitting here for years. It's not quite done. It just needs a few line drawings on the owls in the U.S. and Canada. So the other one was on snowy owls.
And how do they get a hold of these books?
Those are Mountain Press in Missoula, publishing company. I don't even know if you can get them anymore, but we're working on a number of things now. And and then, you know, the research papers are all pretty much online and all that. And then I'm working on a big account right now for the Birds of the World, writing the supposed, you know, authoritative account on the snowy owls, which is pretty big, and I have a number of co-authors helping on that.
Your website indicates there's a book called What an Owl Knows. It's by Jennifer Ackerman. I guess they can get that from Amazon?
Yeah, it's a great book. Jennifer Ackerman is, you know, one of the, probably the top science bird writers, you know, of our generation right now. She's had a number of books, and this one, I think it ended up number 6 on the New York Times best-selling list when it came out just last year. And she visited us and came in the field. And I think, you know, if you asked her, she was pretty overwhelmed. She actually got to see wildlife researchers in action. She helped out capturing and banding owls and searching for nests. And she spent a week with us. And we've all become pretty good pals since then.
So what is the ORI website?
Owlinstitute.org, I think.
Okay. And looks like we've run out of time, but...
Okay. Well, to have people visit our website, you know, we always, you know, we're trying to match grants, we always need equipment, you know, things of that sort, you know, snowmobiles, four wheels. It's amazing how much equipment you have to have when you run a field research organization. So we even need a house in Barrow, Alaska, if anybody's up for that, so to continue our snowy owl research. So anyway, yeah, have people go to our website and then help support our work.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you very much, Denver. This has been great. Fascinating world of owls to talk about. That's really been interesting. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Jay. I appreciate the opportunity to share our work and we'll see where it goes. Thank you.
Our guest today has been Denver Holt. He's the president of the Owl Research Institute in Charlo, Montana. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com, see additional features of our website, or to kgvm.org. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.